Blog Talk Radio.
Okay, everyone, welcome once again to Kay Thompson Live. I'm Kay Thompson, and we're experimenting with different kinds of music, and here on Kay Thompson Live. And let me tell you what we're going to be talking about tonight. We're going to be talking to Professor and Dr. Robert Kirvin. He has a new book out, and the name of his new book is Inside Newark, and we're going to be finding out about the political history of Newark. Now, he has a former book out that had come out some years ago by Robert Kirvin, and that was Blackout Looting, and that covered a lot of the politics in Newark and how the rioting came about. So, you know, we're going to be getting with that in a minute, but just let me tell you who's going to be co-hosting. We have Wayne Gilman, who's going to be calling in tonight, and Wayne Gilman is the former news director of WLIB, BLS, and quite knowledgeable about Newark and New Jersey in the metropolitan area. And as we all know, that Newark has a new look, and new looks all over Newark. It's really a great town to be doing business in, to be involved in politics, to be involved in the educational system. And so many people are involved with just improving Newark, New Jersey, and really the state. So we're adding to the different things available in Newark and downtown Newark. And that, of course, includes some of our authors. Early on during the whole program on New Jersey, Kay Thompson Live, we did talk to Junius Williams, who also had put out in Newark that was the Unfinished Agenda, fascinating book. So you will want to be involved with that book. Right now, we're going to be hoping that Wayne Gilman is going to be calling in, and he should be joining us very shortly. And he's got my co-host. He's the former news director for WLIB BLS. And my other co-host will be tonight, special guest Bill Payne. Bill Payne was a former assemblyman in the New Jersey Assembly. So he's going to be joining us talking to Robert Kirvin, author. Let me tell you a little bit about Bob Kirvin. He is a distinguished senior policy fellow at the Edward Blaustein School at Rutgers, the School of Planning and Public Policy at Rutgers University. He is also previous president of Green Tree Foundation, and he's vice president and director of Ford Foundation, Poverty. Past member of the editorial board of the New York Times, with degrees and a PhD from Princeton and Rutgers. So as soon as he calls in, we are going to get right into this discussion. A lot of things going on in New Jersey, and a lot of things going on across all the whole world. Of course, they're scared to death about the whole Ebola situation. I was going over some of the books that I have, and I have so many different books, especially interviewing a whole lot of different people when I was on WLIB BLS and learned so many things. And one of the things that I was very involved with was police community relations with the different communities, you know, in our different cities. And one of the things that we did over at WLIB during that time was to set up a segment for a group of African-American police persons. And the group was called the Guardians, and the person who was the head of the Guardians was one Dr. Aliyah Rahman. And some time ago, I had talked about his book. So while we are waiting to hear from Robert Kirvin, we will be talking about a number of different things, but mainly I want to mention this book again by Aliyah Rahman. And as I said, I had interviewed him some time ago, and it's really an interesting thing about what the African American police people were going through during the rioting, after the rioting, how they were treated, of course, how the different people in the community were treated, and how the black policemen came about with the organization of black policemen called the Guardians. And what we did over at WLIB Radio was to, you know, provide them with a voice to communicate to the public and to the general public to let them know that they were there, number one, that they were supporting the community, but at the same time they were supporting law and order in the city and, of course, out of the city. So he is a very interesting person, and we're going to be talking to him, you know, just as soon as I can find out where to get in touch with him, but that'll come. But yeah, I'm just looking through this book right now. I'm so he eventually, by the way, he was not only the head of the Guardians Police Department at that time, but he then went to go to the to be the head of one of the jails, and I think that jail was Rikers Island, and really fascinating, absolutely fascinating. So in a few minutes, we're going to be hearing from Wayne Gilman. And Wayne, if you're on, just say hello. Bob Kervin, if you're on, Dr. Kervin, if you're on, just say hello, and we can get right to you. So anyway, we were talking about this police department, and a lot of people had come to finally, you know, be very interested in black policemen protecting the community, which was very unusual during that time. But then to get back to Professor Bob Kervin, his book came about, the first one that I'm going to be mentioning while we were waiting for Dr. Kervin to call in. It describes the what was happening in the eruption of looting, with the eruption of looting during the power failure in New York City in July 13th, and how this sort of the whole thing about the looting and happening during that movement at that particular time. People had gotten pretty sick and tired of being sick and tired about racism in the metropolitan area and all over the country. And as a matter of fact, with all the flare-ups around the country right now, I see some of the same things happening because of police-community relations. And it's amazing some of the things that are happening. History does repeat itself. So as soon as we can get to Dr. Kervin, we will be continuing with this. But I want to talk just a little bit more about Dr. Ali Al-Rahman. And came a point where he was the head of Rikers Island, as I was saying. Now, I remember being out on a boat going off the, I think it was up the Hudson or out there, and in a boat, and we drove by this very desolate-looking place. And that desolate-looking place was Rikers Island, rather. And that was in, I don't know, up here in New York, or I forget exactly, but it was in the Bronx or, you know, Queens or whatever. But anyway, it was very desolate-looking. And it's so desolate-looking, as a matter of fact, that it was frightening. So, but anyway, we passed it, and then we found out that as we were going past it, that there was another big boat out that also was a prison on a boat, within the boat. So, you know, the experience in doing broadcast journalism and doing so many talk shows and finding out so many things about what's happening in the cities, in the state, and in the country, you know, really makes you very skeptical about the way some parts of the government is being administered to certain people in certain areas. But anyway, Kay Thompson Live here, and we're waiting to hear from Wayne Gilman. And Wayne Gilman is one of our co-hosts here. Eric Payne is on a job assignment with the Congressman, Donald Payne Jr., and so he will not be here. So that leaves me and you, or you and I, you and me. So we're waiting to hear from Robert Kervin, who is the author of his new book. And the name of his new book, everyone, is Inside Newark. So we're waiting to hear exactly what the political history is of Newark and why the demise of Newark happened and how it brought about this rioting and what happened as a result. So it's a political history of Newark. This goes back to the days of Mayor Athanasio in Newark. So we're going to be talking all about that. And we are going to be joined with Wayne Gilman and also Bill Payne. And we're waiting for them to call in now. And we can get busy talking to them. So if you are you on the air? Hello, are you on the air? Wayne Gilman, if you're on the air, just say hello. Bill Payne, if you're on the air, just say hello. Something is not coming through. We're not being heard for some reason, or either I can't hear. So, hello, you're on the air. Bill Payne, we're waiting to hear from you. I'm Kay Thompson. This is Kay Thompson Live, and we are also waiting to talk to Bob Kervin. who is the author of Inside Newark. And when you read this book, you are going to be absolutely amazed. We're going to be finding out all about the book. And as I was saying, he is one of the key people in Newark, with a lot of other people who, during the time of before the riots, had participated in, quelling things down. And really interesting information. Also, the Inside Newark covers the political figures who really made an important contribution to Newark, New Jersey, as a matter of fact, to New Jersey. So, and Bob, I think Robert Kirby will speak up to the administration in this book of Cory Booker. And as you know, Cory Booker is a senator right now. And so what we're going to be doing is awaiting for that. And hopefully we will be playing some music during that particular time and trying to get on with what's going on with our equipment here. It's been a rainy day, and we are having some difficulty, but hopefully we will be able to do this. By the way, let me continue talking about the Alia Rockman's book, because this is really very important. I was telling you that he was the president of the Guardians, which was probably, I don't know if I would say it, that it was the most powerful police, black police organization in the country. But if not, then it comes close to it. They really changed the way the community thought about the police department, and also changed the way some of the other policemen were treating members of the black community. So I remember that quite well. And there were a lot of key figures in the Guardians, and so many people owe them a lot of, kudos and a lot of thanks for what they did in the community, trying to keep everything as fair as possible with the community and with the police department, some members of the police department. Those were the days, and really some very awful days, some very happy days, and certainly things were moving, very heavily and quite quickly. And we, in media, we in talk radio, had a lot to do with that. Wayne Gilman over there on WLIB was the news director, I was saying, and he was right in the midst of things. And there was David Lampel and the Suttons, of course, and so many different people. But the Guardians were the guardians of the community. They were the guardians, and we want to really give thanks to Ali al-Rahman. So, we are waiting to hear from Bill Payne. Do you want the number for him to call in? So let me give you the number for Bill Payne to call in. And it's not going through. We are trying to rectify this situation right now. It could be because of the weather, because we did have some trouble with electricity and all that kind of stuff. The call-in number to call into the studio is 323. Oh, I'm sorry, is, wait a minute, let me get that. Let me see. Okay, we're doing that right now. Once again, so it's, bear with us, everyone. We will be right back. We're not going anywhere. I'm going to continue talking, by the way. 646. Here we are. Yeah. So I'm trying to hear. And we also have the other number for other people to call in. If Wayne is listening, Wayne, you can call in, I think, on the 323 number, 679-0906, 323-679-0906. So we are waiting to hear from Robert Kirvin, and he is probably hanging on the phone, I know, because we are having difficulty. Now, this is the first time this has happened, and this is the first time that I'm going to continue talking during this whole time. But we are in an exciting time, by the way. We're also in an awful time. And the reason why it's so awful is because of the fact that these different, hateful acts are springing up all around the country. Every time you turn on television, or if you're a news junkie like I am, you will find out that there is a lot of things going on about the killings, about the beatings, about all kinds of things, and about people in upheaval. and about the health of the country, meaning about the Ebola virus and the possible consequences of that. And of course, our government people are working very hard to keep the Ebola virus, you know, in check. And this is very difficult. You know, I happen to know some people with the CDC, and they are working very, very hard. Our government is working very, very hard. I find it amazing that in the midst of all this turmoil that, you know, really hits all of us, not only black people, not only white people, but all of us, for goodness sakes, from every culture, and we are still at battle with each other about something so trivial as race. So Wayne's number is a, let me see, where is Wayne's number here? So we're going to be seeing, I know he's probably trying to get through. And Bill Payne, I know, is trying to get through. And the call-in numbers, I wonder if I should take this off. So I'm supposed to be keeping talking. But anyway, I was talking about the upheaval in the country itself. It's awful. And but I have to say to people that what's happening, too, is, and I don't understand this, why people are blaming the President of the United States for some of these things. And, of course, we all know it's plain politics and bad politics at that. You know, you have the Republicans blaming Obama for everything except life. So if we are going to be a united country and, you know, continuing on in a forward direction, then we have to respect the people that we have voted in office. And unfortunately, in a lot of different circles, this is not happening for one reason or another. And the reasons are very, very trivial. They are so stupid as to not even be believed. You know, people who are still involved with making a difference with people of color, well, people aren't going anywhere, so you might as well accept people. You know, and together, you know, we can move toward a much better way of life. We can move toward a better society. It doesn't take a lot for people to get along. So why in the world would you want to battle with your neighbor? You know, we are also multi-talented and multifaceted. We have so much that we can do. We are all sitting on gold mines, meaning that you can do a whole lot of things. You can be so enthused about what you do and what you enjoy doing that you can do it. And so many times people are very negative, and they start blaming their neighbor for something. And then they start blaming the government. And then they it gets to be to the point where it's really ridiculous when you think about it. Now, here I am talking, and I'm not getting any response from everywhere, so I think I may be talking to myself, so I'm just going to talk a whole lot, which I do anyway. But I think, too, that if you want to improve your way of thinking, if you want to really extend your thinking about other people and how you can, you know, improve your lives, do something with your lives, because I know a lot of people, you know, they get to a point where they're very depressed. And you have to really find out the reasons for that depression. And one thing you have to do, I would say, is believe in visualization. And I think I talked about this some time ago. There is a book called The Art of Visualization by a woman called Genevieve Bayrand. And that was written so many years ago. As a matter of fact, I tried to get a copy of the book again a couple of weeks ago. Now, this book is a book that I had gotten about in the early or the late 60s. And this woman was talking about the philosophy of the art of visualization. When you want something, when you need something that will make you feel alive and living and whatnot, if you want to do something with your life, whatever you want to do, all you have to do is visualize and believe. Visualize yourself doing it. Visualize yourself, you know, fulfilling your dream. What is it that you've always wanted to do? Do you want to talk negatively about people, or do you want to be a positive person and add, you know, to your community, add to, you know, your life, and add to other people around you? It's all about helping people, and it's all about being informed about what's going on in your community, in your city, in your state. And how can you do that in a positive way? Well, one way is to vote. Vote for people, you know, who believe the good things in life. Vote for people who will be for other people, who will be in a category of the people who want to move things in a positive way for all people on this planet. All right, who knows, we may not be on this planet very long, what with the world changing as it was changing. But certainly we don't have to add to a whole negative stream, excuse me, a negative stream of thought, because that can be very dangerous. It's also silly. It's also a waste of time. You know, so if you practice the art of visualization, I think you would be very pleased with that. We're going to try again to get this, this going. I think we're having a technical problem because the internet is down. The rain is causing us to have the storm is causing us to go off the air. We cannot get through. Off the internet, rather, and we just cannot get through. So I think I'm going to, we're going to go to maybe some music right now and see if we can sort of revive this thing. I don't know how to do it, but we're certainly going to try. Anyway, I'm Kay Thompson here for Kay Thompson Live. Stay with us, everyone. We'll try to be right back. Okay, everyone, I'm back. Kay Thompson Live here, Kay Thompson. And we are trying to get through. We seem to be having difficulty with the internet. And we're not the only ones. I don't know if this could be because of the tornado and the weather, of a few days ago. So we are having trouble here with our equipment. Not with our equipment, but going on the air. I have no way of knowing who's listening. And I have no way of knowing if this... Yeah, I'm repeating. Are we on?
I'm on.
Is that Wayne or Bill Payne? Who is it? Is this Bill Payne or Robert Curvin?
This is Robert Curvin.
Hi, Bob. Sorry about that, but we're having a lot of difficulty here with the internet.
I know, I think it's because of the Devils are playing their first game. And there's a lot of media downtown that interferes with the internet and communications.
Oh, okay, at the Prudential Arena?
Right, exactly.
Oh, yeah, we hadn't taken that into consideration. But I won't apologize for being late because it was a difficulty that we're having.
Well, I've been on since 8 o'clock.
Wow, so you heard me.
I've listened to you talk, and you've had a lot to say.
Yeah.
But I don't think you can hear me.
Yes, I can.
You're not receiving. Are you receiving my voice now?
Yes, very much so, yes. Can you hear me?
You are, okay.
All right, but Bob, listen, I was talking about your book, Inside Newark, and I was also talking about your past book, Blackout Looting. So my first question to you is, with you covering the politics in Newark and the life in Newark, we get to, from the demise of Newark, how do we get to this? What's going on right now?
I don't know.
So, well, tell us about your book, Inside Newark. What are you covering? What are you talking about?
Okay, well, let me tell you that, first of all, I wrote the book because I think I've lived in the city for many, many years. I was actually born here. I was raised in the nearby town of Belleville as a young child, and I went off to the Army, and I came back, and I've been in some way active in civic, civil rights, political life for all of my life. Right here in the city of Newark, although I spent a long and very wonderful part of my professional career working in New York. But when I left the job and sort of thought I was going to retire, I thought it was time for me to actually tell my own story and how I saw the efforts to transform Newark into a more viable, better place for everyone. So I thought it would be helpful to, in a sense, to go back to an earlier period and to discuss the way in which the city had actually changed by demographic changes, by social changes, by changes in the economy, decentralization of jobs and things like that, that the city itself had really no power to change. And many of these forces, like federal housing policy, which was terribly racist and exclusionary, had a very profound impact on the development of the city into a neighborhood, series of neighborhoods of enclaves, racially defined, and particularly for black people who were discriminated against even as renters, but even discriminated against in the financial and banking systems. So that in the early 50s and the post-World War II era, when many families began buying homes in the suburbs, which were quite cheap, by the way. In some cases, if you were white, you could buy a home, pay a mortgage, and end up paying less cost than you had paid renting a house, actually, in the city of Newark. So it was a very lucrative and appealing deal for people who were considered okay. But for black people, they were clearly excluded by a practice called redlining, which, in a sense, making certain neighborhoods, closed neighborhoods so that blacks could not move in them, but also creating or establishing criteria in the banking system that essentially said, if you're white, you're okay to get a loan, a mortgage loan, but if you're black, you're not okay. In fact, there's some really interesting literature in the archives that tell how these rules of segregation and discrimination were actually applied. And they were very overt about it. I mean, it was not something that was even hidden. They put it in pamphlets like, don't give a loan to a black family just because they're sending their child to college and they think that they should live better and among white people. Things of that kind were actually printed in documents. And so very often we don't realize how complicit the government was in establishing this system of segregation. Okay? Now you wanted to ask me something? Kay?
Yeah. Yes, I'm here.
Are you listening?
Yeah, I'm listening.
Okay.
I am.
So, so the thing that I would say is that, or two things. One is that segregation and the kind of forceful exclusion from the participation in the housing market leads to a lot of other deficits. So that related to this is the unavailability of decent schooling, for example. The concentration of many, many poor people together creates health issues that there is not equal services or adequate services to treat health problems. So the segregation actually spins off a lot of other very, very negative and harmful effects. The second thing I would say is that, you know, as we've lived through this era, and you mentioned as you were talking the rebellion of 1967, one of the things that one would hope is that when you have an experience like that in a society that is supposed to be intelligent, civil, interested in learning, that you would take away the lessons, even though they are very hard-earned, and some people actually gave up their life in their in the rebellion. There were 26 people who died, and 24 of them were non-uniform civilians, almost entirely African Americans. You would think that we would learn something from that kind of experience. We would learn how to create a more efficient police department. We would learn how to be more egalitarian in terms of our administration of justice. We would learn how not to abuse and target citizens just because they are black. And so here we are from 1967 and the 1960s, when there were disturbances all over the country, and then suddenly we're faced with a series of brutal, shocking assaults with weapons by police officers or people under the guise of trying to act in the name of law against young black men. And so from Newark, 1967, to Ferguson, 2014, we have learned very little, if anything. And to me, that's the real tragedy of what has occurred, that the resistance to learning, the almost entrenched ignorance and defiance against more civil, fair, egalitarian policies that would make this a better society. And you mentioned, too, how tense things are at the present time, how much conflict there is, and neighbors arguing with neighbors, and Obama, rather than being a symbol of the advancement of our society in terms of his thinking of race, has become a target to actually illuminate how deeply racist the society is. Because the man is not, clearly, the man is not being judged in a fair way as a leader of the world who, he's made some mistakes and he's not been perfect. But when you think of what we've had over the last several presidential terms, he has an outstanding record, and he has done a remarkable job. And he just happens to be a black man. Many people, it appears, cannot get over that, and that he is judged by a different lens. Okay, you got somebody else on?
Yeah, Bill Payne, I think he wants to join in on this conversation. But I'm so glad to hear you, because so many people have said to me, why are you still talking about desegregation? Why are you still talking about racism? Why are you still doing a whole lot of things? Because it exists, and I'm so glad that you wrote this book. Bill, join us, if you will. We're waiting for Gwen Gilman also.
Sure, yeah. Hi, Bob?
Yes, Bill.
Okay, yes. Yeah, I'm glad to hear. I'm glad to be able to get in. And first of all, I want to commend you on the book that you wrote.
Thank you.
You've captured the years that we both lived through here in the city of Newark. You captured it very, very well. I had the opportunity, obviously, to be involved with some of the things that were going on in the city of Newark. For some reason, I got involved and interested in government and politics early on, and kind of followed it throughout my life. But one of the things, it seems, I had an opportunity to speak to a class up at Essex County College up in West Caldwell the other night, as a matter of fact, and civil liberties group, and one of the things that has certainly stayed uppermost in my mind is this business of racism. There were some who were talking at one time that we were living in a post-racial society. Obviously, that's not the case. And it seems as though racism is in the DNA of this country. People come from other parts of the world, and many have come to this country to escape tyranny and things of that nature. But yet, when they get here, it seems as though they buy into the racism or what have you that seems to be, that is prevalent rather here in this country. And the fact that many of the people that are here now are descended from, you know, the 14 million or so people that came, they were welcomed by the Statue of Liberty, but to escape, as I say, the tyranny of the country they came from. But when they get here after a period of time, they seem to adopt the kind of behavior, anti-minority, anti-black behavior, behavior of citizens who have been here, blacks who have been here for 300 or 400 years, descended from those. But it seems as though there's something in the DNA of this country, this melting pot experiment that we are supposedly taking part in this country, where people from all over the world come together and they're mixed together and they come out as Americans believing in liberty, et cetera. It's not working. And I don't know, I just don't understand the reason for it. Except that I was told the other day that, well, after all, Bill, this is a new experiment, and that this country, the United States of America, is a new nation among the family of nations. We are a couple of hundred years old, and so maybe when our nation is as old as matured enough, that we may one day reach that goal of liberty and justice for all. I don't know. Maybe it's because we're a young nation, but it's just the racism is still so very, very, very deep in this country. And
I want to jump in here for a minute, gentlemen. I want to also, mention again to Bill Payne, who's a former assemblyman. We're talking to Bob Carvin, who is the author of Inside Newark, an excellent book. You told me because you read it. Bobby, I didn't get to the book yet, but I'm thinking about it, and the reason for you being on is to, really talk about this book. People up to date about what's going in Newark, how we got to this particular point, and what's going to be going on. And also,
right.
Newark look.
We lost you?
Hey, this is the co-host, Eric Payne, here.
This is Bob Curvin.
Hi, Mr. Curvin. How are you? This is Eric. And
I'm good.
Hello to my dad. It appears that as I'm trying to monitor the studio here at a location that I am at South Ward headquarters in North New Jersey, it seems that we lost them. And as we were saying earlier, with the weather and with the Devils playing and there being so much activity with a lot of the news trucks and things. Sometimes these things happen. But we're very impressed about your book. And I heard you making the correlation, if I'm not mistaken, to what happened with the rebellion here in Newark and the uprising and rebellion in Ferguson. And as someone from a different generation of you and my father, I wanted to know what is if you're seeing a different approach with the young people, because you guys were young at that time, relatively young.
Right.
And do you see a different
approach?
Yeah,
we were young once upon a time.
Do you see a different approach that these young people in Ferguson are taking? Because, in the news about a week or two ago, they had a little bit of a tiff with the elders in the community there that wouldn't let them speak, and they were having going a back and forth. So I'm just wondering, I guess the opposed question to you and my father as well. Do you guys see a different tactic that this generation has to take?
Yeah. Well, I think that there were definite instances of different thinking and different views about what was going on in Newark between younger people and older people. As it happened, by the way, the larger number of people out in the street were really young people, teenagers and even younger than that, adolescents, who, you know, quite frankly, also saw an element of frivolity and fun in the disaster, even while the more serious things about the life of this driver who had been beaten by the police was, you know, being considered by elders and other responsible political leaders and elected officials and so on. And, I, you know, over the years, I've seen this gap. What I have not seen, however, is a change in the manner in which police administration in this nation, and I would say even beyond police administration, I would say law enforcement administration, the administration of what we call justice, has changed in any profound way to prevent the occurrence of these incidents like this. And then secondly, in the process of adjudication of court hearings and trials and so on, African Americans and Latino Americans, people of color, are still treated so extremely unfair that our jails are just loaded with this population of mass incarceration, and many cases with people who have not even committed a crime, but they've been faced with a trial that would lead to such a punitive result that they've actually agreed to a plea bargain that puts them in jail anyway. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's just, we are, as a society, going all over the world telling people how they can benefit by having a democracy. And we haven't straightened out this scene here yet ourselves. It's so hypocritical. And to me, you know, when you look around on the street corners today, and one of the big problems that we are facing is this global economic situation, which really has taken away many of the even small-time jobs that as young people we used to get. You know, I worked in a department store, a soda factory. Well, those jobs are not available for young people today. And the reality is that you have, you know, hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of men of color with nothing to do, who are essentially rootless. And I think that they represent the vulnerability, the risk to this society right here at home. To me, the risks are not in Turkey or in Afghanistan or anywhere else. They're right here in the United States, and we have not come up with any answers as to address these issues.
So let me just get Thompson, our host. Very strange for me to call.
Yes. I'm here.
You're back on, so I would just continue to discuss the discussion for you. I want to get you here, Dad. I just wanted to say, Mr. Cooper, it sounds like you're saying really the way that the system has.
I'm having some difficulty hearing here. Hello?
Hello?
Can you hear me? Yeah.
You're on, Dad.
I can hear you, Bill.
Hear you.
Okay, yeah, we're kind of breaking up. The fact that Bob mentions that we have the same conditions that we had. The criminal justice system or the penal system is terribly unfair. I mean, obviously it's racist oriented. That's the vast majority of people that are in prisons we know are black or Hispanics, et cetera. And even there are those who are in jail now who are held in jail because they can't come up with a low bail, for instance. I mean, there may be people in our jails now who are unable to come up with, let's say, a $500 bail. So therefore, they're held in jail for extended periods of time. No one seems to be concerned about this except black folks. For instance, no one else wants to talk about the conditions that exist and the unfair conditions that exist against African Americans, young people, as Bob says, no jobs, nothing for them to do. However, if you're in mixed company, very, very often, Bob, I don't know if you experience this, but I know I do. If I'm in mixed company with whites, et cetera, and you discuss this problem of racism, they get uncomfortable still. They don't want to talk about it, most of them.
Right.
It's something they don't want to
denial.
Deal with.
Denial.
Exactly. And I right. until they all of us accept the fact that, number one, this problem is not going to be resolved by putting our heads in the sand or putting their heads in the sand. It's there and
right.
it's impacting everybody. We've got to have to engage people, no matter how uncomfortable it is for them. They can imagine how uncomfortable physically it is for so many of our people. But there just seems to be a refusal to deal with the truth of the matter. It's, my God, as you say, 95% of the people in prisons, in the youth houses, in places like that, are African American youngsters, Hispanic youngsters, and
right.
no one seems to care about it except some blacks. And I guess after a period of time, there's some blacks who are tired of fighting. Now, I'm no longer in the prime of my life. We've been involved in this for a long time. And the younger folks have not been, perhaps haven't seen the enemy as vividly as we had. For instance, we knew there were no black elected officials. There were no blacks getting decent jobs. So some of us, way back when, we targeted those things. We fought against them. I think that the young people of today have not experienced what we experienced and don't seem to have a clear target to fight against. I don't know. It's very, very disheartening. But I haven't given up on it. We can't.
You can't give up.
Let me just pick up on that, Emma. I want to get you back in this conversation as well. And speaking of younger generation, I believe that we did have a kind of a facade for us, a fantasy that we kind of thought, and I can tell you from my own personal experience in going to some of these marches as a child with you, Dad, Mom, and experiencing and hearing remembering what little I remember about the riots at the time, I remember thinking, well, it'll be okay by the time I become an adult. It'll be okay. And for a point during the 70s and moving to the suburbs and things like that, certain African Americans were able to break through and have a piece of that middle class life. We, in my generation, kind of thought things were going to be okay. I mean, we dealt with racism a little bit. It's not in the stark contrast of your generation. Really, your generation was the ones that said, in my personal opinion, that said, we have to make a change now or we're forever going to be treated like second-class citizens. We're forever going to have the second-class jobs offered to us. So now is the time to make that change. And everybody kind of went all in, so to speak, and put skin in the game to say, not enough. And my generation, I believe, had a kind of little of a fantasy trip done on us until we got smacked in the middle of right in the face with the racism that we might have experienced a little bit as we got a little bit older, late teens, early 20s. Then certainly in the 30s, it starts really to hit home that America has not, in fact, changed at all. And so I kind of see the ball dropping in my generation a little bit, and in terms of passing the baton on to the next generation. And it didn't take us, I think, in mass and bulk until the election of the first African-American president. And seeing the reaction, the vile reaction, for us to really realize that there is no difference or very little difference between now and the 60s and what you guys experienced. And
yeah,
perspective. Yeah, in one way I would disagree, because the reality is that we've got a much larger middle class, which is a point that you're making, I think, that some people did grab the opportunity they saw about them and they moved ahead. And, you know, there are blacks in many positions that we couldn't even think of holding in the 60s and when we were growing up. In fact, you know, Bill and I, we went to Rutgers University, and when we got out of college, the only thing that we could do was to take a civil service exam and get a state job. The corporations were just totally closed to us. But that's not true today. But at the same time, that growing middle class has led people to believe that everybody's middle class, you know, that there's no, what, you know, like, what's the problem? You know, you got a black president, you got a middle class, you got this, you got, and at the same time, we have this growing population of unemployed people, struggling people who are still trying to make it, and everything that's being done, like the creation of these special charter schools, is to leave those folks behind. That's the nature of this double bind that we're in. On one hand, we've got some progress that we could point to. We've got a black president. On the other hand, we've got still serious problems, and people don't want to talk about it. And Bill said, you can't even have a conversation with a white person about race today because, we don't want to talk about it. We don't want to raise that. You know, that's a non-starter. You know, that's going to create problems if we even talk about it. We've got to talk about it, and we can't accept the status quo. We can't accept where we are. If we are lucky enough, as I have been, have many of our friends have been, to fight through this system, get an education, achieve things, our obligation is to look back and say, how do I bring some other people along with us? And that's what we've got to do. We've got to find new leadership. We've got to find new ways of working. The old civil rights movement is gone. We're never going to have that kind of massive marching and mobilization of people like we had. But we've got to have some alternative. We can't sit back and say, well, we can't do nothing. That's not acceptable. It's just not acceptable.
Bob, let me also, in your book, you touch upon some of the problems that we have experienced with some of our elected officials. We got more and more of African Americans elected to public office, et cetera. Some of them have disappointed us. Some of them have not taken the job seriously to try to bring about changes or improvements in the community. And I think that one of the things that we need to do is to hold people accountable. If, in fact, they become elected to public office, then they must use that position not to enrich themselves but to enrich the community. And I think we've had some experiences over the past years that have caused us to say, well, once we get there, we'll be able to make some changes. But unfortunately, in too many instances, there have been people who've gotten into office who simply have forgotten that they're there to serve the public and not themselves. And I think you touch upon some of these things in your book that you wrote.
Absolutely. And shocking because, you know, many of them, you know, they made great honorable promises how they, if they got into power, they would serve children. They would worry about, you know, making this a better society. But, power, as they said, power corrupts.
Yeah,
and if you're not strong, and if you're not committed, you end up seeing it as mainly a personal opportunity to, go buy some fine suits and shirts and ties and look good, and then I'm happy. What's your problem?
And if I could just point out, that's where the media comes in. And, Mom, I want to get you in here because being on LIB all of those years, you had David Dinkins was mayor, and that was the rise of Al Sharpton. How were you able to use the media, because I've heard you guys do it, use the media to keep some of these politicians that might go astray, keep them back on track in terms of that related to the community? Okay, this is a question.
What had happened was that, yes, we did use the power of the media. And we were also supporting all kinds of movements and all kinds of people who were also on the same page. We knew what racism was, and everybody else knew about it. It was our job. As a matter of fact, I always thought it was my personal job, let people know that we weren't going to stand for it. I was so annoyed when I found out about, you know, the segregation in schools. You know, it was still going on, and it's still going on to this day. And people with people incarcerated. there are more black men in jail who don't deserve to be there. And I'm saying that a lot of them don't deserve to be there. There's a whole lot that don't deserve to be there.
That's right.
Now, let me just ask you one question, Ma, because this was the time that you were on LIB was also the time, and we're coming up just on 3 minutes, 3 minutes and about 20 seconds left in the show, just so everybody knows.
Okay.
The time that you were on WLIB was the time, really was the rise of Al Sharpton, when people were didn't know if he was a charlatan, if he was using his position as a minister, a religious man for his own purposes. And I think it was shaping him that caused him to, from looking back now, looking back at that time, that kind of caused him to get a little bit more serious about being a black leader. Is that correct?
Yes, yes. As a matter of fact, I'm so amused by that because it backfired on him. The Al Sharpton became one of the most important. Okay? Let me tell you right now. He is being heard. He has met with the president. Listen, I want to end with this. Inside Newark is the book to get by Professor Bob Kervin. Robert Kervin. Thank you, Bill, for coming on. Thank you, Bob. We've had the difficulty
thank you.
With
thank you very
things.
Much. Buy the book. Thank you, Kay. Good to talk to you,
we'll
Bill.
We'll do it again.
Thank
you,
Eric.
Right.
Wayne
did
not get in, but we will be doing this again next week, weather permitting. Thank you.
Right.
Thank you. Okay.
All right. Thank
good night.
You. And just to wrap up, because as I said, we're just about on 2 minutes, a minute show. You want to close down the show, Ma, and talk about just some of, like I said, close us out with some of those experiences that you remember. Well, as I was saying, Kate, we're still on, and as I remember, I'll close out the show. Very rarely get a chance to do that on the Blog Talk Radio Network / Kate Thompson Live Show. That's the direct website that you can go to. BlogTalkRadio.com/ Kate Thompson Live is how you can hear our show. And we want you to know that you can listen Wednesday evening at 8 live, and this was really live radio, if you know what I mean. But us on the archives, and you can go to the Live Talk Radio / K Thompson Live Show page.
You can listen to
other discussions as well. And as I was saying, helping, I think, really refine Reverend Al Sharpton and the experiences that he had, and people would interview him on WLIB. I think that really helped to refine him kind of finding himself a more serious leader, or people taking him more serious, certainly. And anyone that was around back in those days certainly experienced and saw, I believe, the growth of Reverend Al Sharpton to the very serious kind of voice he is for our community, a strong voice for the African American cable television news station that anybody that knows or is aware of Reverend Al from those days is quite, I'm sure, quite pleased his growth. So this is Blog Talk Radio, the Kate Thompson Live Show. My name is Eric Payne. I am the son. I don't know if Kay, my mom is still on, but in her name, I'd like to say thanks for listening to us. We hope you'll tune in again next week on the Kate Thompson Live Show here on the Blog Talk Radio. Thanks. Listen to us.